Natural Living with Gary Nall, Mondays and Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Oh, a happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I'd like to welcome you to this program. I call this the Empowerment Hour. I intend to share insights, information, all relevant to our well-being during the next hour. The latest on health and healing, always from mainstream peer-reviewed literature, but from independent scientists, not affiliated with any special interest group. My guest in the second part of our program will be J.B. Handley, along with his wife, founded the Generation Rescue. And today they are going to challenge Brian Deer and some of the differences between the U.S. and British healthcare systems. After all, Dr. Andrew Wakefield has been excoriated in the world media. He has been outcast and thrown aside as a fraudulent scientist who intentionally misled the world in believing there was an association between the MMR vaccines and autism, or so claims his accuser, Brian Deer. Who is Brian Deer? Did the American media, including Anderson Cooper, who attacked Dr. Wakefield, and all the rest, did they take the time to look at this person's background? No, we have. And we'll show you why the American media cannot be trusted. So that's in the second part. I have a lot of information to share, including new information from a Professor Richard Death, professor of pharmacology at Northwestern University, on what is in the MMR vaccine that is causing inflammation, and new information that actually confirmed the problems out of Harvard, confirmed the problems on the MMR vaccine and what it's doing to the gastrointestinal tract of children. This is something that no one has been told about, but we will give you that information a little later on in the show. So we have a lot to share today. So I'm asking you now to get a pen and paper because you're going to need it. Let's begin. We know that we need sunlight for helping our immune systems to help prevent cancer, but there's new research showing that if we don't get enough sun, it can cause rickets. This, according to Professor Nicholas Clark, quote, "This is a problem of lifestyle and children across the social classes." And this is from the BBC, and it says, "Children growing up in Victorian slums suffer from bone deformities, such as bowed legs and curvature of the spine. It was discovered it was caused by a lack of vitamin D manufactured when the sun is exposed to sunlight. The condition was thought to have been consigned to history in the 1940s when it was added to everyday foods. However, rickets is making a comeback, and now they've seen that the teenage lifestyle is the cause. Why? Because they're not spending enough time outside. There's more time spent inside working on computers and twittering than outside, which is now causing vitamin D deficiency, which is leading once again to rickets." How about that? So we got to get the kids away from the TVs, away from the computers, put down that little magic box that they communicate with, and get them out playing in the sun. Want to live to be 100? Adopt a rosy outlook. Born in 1911 in Memphis, 3 years after the first Model T Ford hit the road and 3 years before the start of World War I, Dorothy Nixon will turn 100 next month. The way she describes it, reaching 100 years of age is almost an act of willpower. A positive attitude and strong will are crucial to staying active and engaged late in life, even when you don't feel up to it. She lives now in a small village apartment on Signal Mountain. Quote, "You don't ever feel just perfectly good. You feel sleepy and lazy and slow. You have to just absolutely make yourself do things," she says, "to stay active." For Nixon, that includes a 40-minute exercise class 3 times a week. They call it chair exercise, which sounds awful sissy, but it's not. You do get up and stand up and work your legs, and researchers are finding evidence that attitudes play a crucial role in healthy aging. With the disclaimer there's no secret recipe for reaching 100 for everyone, researchers with the Georgia Centurion Society have concluded that a combination of attitude and personality traits are the keys to longevity. Keeping centurions healthy and independent for as long as possible will become increasingly important. Why? Because there's 68 million baby boomers, and that means a lot of people are going to simply say no to the aging process. But how many people are over 100 now? You ready for this number? 64,000 live in the United States. And then we're expecting that to go up to 600,000 in the near future. So what's got to do? You've got to have a positive attitude. And of course, everything you do beyond that simply helps it. Essential fatty acids are essential for easing the pain of PMS. This is from Reproductive Health, the peer-reviewed journal. It says, quote, "Administering of 1 to 2 grams of essential fatty acids to patients with PMS resulted in a significant decrease in symptom scores. Furthermore, the administration of the dietary supplement did not result in any changes in the total cholesterol." And this was from a Dr. Fada, the lead researcher, Federal University in Brazil. The results, quote, "of the current study present evidence in support of the use of essential fatty acids in PMS patients." Well, that's good, because a lot of us have been recommending this for a long time. And I suggest borage seed oil, evening primrose oil, or flaxseed oil to help in those conditions. And that was published in Volume 8, Issue 2 of Reproductive Health. Now, antioxidants can boost the male urinary tract health. This is also a major study. It says fruits and vegetables are rich in antioxidants. Well, the highest average intake of lycopene and beta-carotene and vitamin A were associated with a 50% reduction in the odds of having the problems with the urinary tract. That was in 1,466 men published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Nutrition. Quote, "Clinically, our results provide support to recommendations for increasing fruits and vegetable consumption, particularly those rich in carotenoids and vitamin C." This was done at Harvard and Northwestern University. So once again, all of you who are taking your green powders and red powders and eating your fruits and vegetables and your berries in the morning and your vegetable shakes and your fruit shakes, you're way on the side of right. Common antibiotics, way overused in the United States, and blood pressure medication can result in hospitalization. Now, this is from Science Daily, as reported in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Research done at Sunnybrook Research Institute, Institute of Clinical Evaluation Sciences. Here's what it says, quote, "Mixing commonly used antibiotics with common blood pressure medications may cause hypotension, which is abnormally low blood pressure, and induce shock, which could be deadly in older patients requiring hospitalization." Well, let's see. A lot of senior citizens are given antibiotics, and most senior citizens are on blood pressure-lowering medication. So could that be one of the reasons why we have had so many iatrogenic episodes in older people? Yeah, that's it. Breast cancer breakthrough. Vitamin D in combination with the sun can be a key to prevention. This was a good study. And it was done at the Institute of National Research and the National Institutes of Health. And here's what it says. Researchers have looked only at levels of vitamin D intake and breast cancer risk. Their findings have been sometimes inconsistent. Does vitamin D definitely have the potential to prevent breast malignancies or not? Well, a large, potentially groundbreaking French study appears to have the answer. The key to breast cancer prevention may well be taking higher amounts of vitamin D through diet and supplements combined with regular direct sunlight exposure. So the two together, the sunlight and the vitamin D, worked together and they caused a 32% lower risk of breast cancer than counterparts living in less sunny latitudes in France. And that was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers, and Prevention. Sunlight and vitamin D. Almonds shown to lower the risk of developing diabetes and cardiovascular disease. This is, who would have thought? And this is published in the Journal of American College of Nutrition, research done at Loma Linda University School of Public Health. Here's what it says. Regular almond consumption is shown to lower the risk of developing diabetes and cardiovascular disease, in part due to the high fiber content and concentrations of monounsaturated fats. Further research demonstrates that almonds contribute to accelerated fat metabolism and can reduce the incidence of overweight and obesity by influencing healthy blood glucose insulin response. A handful of almonds a day can improve your health profile and lower your risk of serious disease. That's good news. Almonds are good for you. It was Edgar Cayce, the sleeping prophet, who said long ago that a handful of almonds, I think he said 6 almonds a day, helps prevent cancer. You want to protect your liver and brain from aging? Silymarin, S-I-L-Y-M-A-R-I-N, or commonly known as milk thistle. The liver and the brain are two metabolically active organs that are under constant attack from disease-promoting free radicals. While elevated cholesterol and triglyceride levels combined with blood glucose abnormalities and obesity can cause damage to the cellular matrix of the liver and the brain that worsens with time, hence you just get older. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease affects about 40% of adults in America, and dementia can touch nearly half of those reaching their 85th birthday. Well, Silymarin is the active component found naturally in milk thistle, and it's shown to provide a significant degree of protection against brain aging and problems with the liver. The liver is called upon to perform over 300 critical metabolic functions within your body every second. And one of these functions is the formation of cholesterol and essential lipids that are required for cellular synthesis and repair. And a diet high in processed carbohydrates, the average American diet, and synthetic hydrogenated fats, like you find in French fries and potato chips and cookies and crackers, can result in excess blood triglycerides, which is a bad thing. And that lodges in the hepatic cells, and that's where you get that problem with the liver. And that's really deadly. That's what's known as non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So, along comes Silymarin, and it protects the nerve, slows brain aging, and helps you. And one final little thing here. Sugar has more devastating effects. Sugar is far more dangerous for our health than it was previously believed. Not only does it rot our teeth and adds padding to our thighs, it can devastate our metabolism. And the culprit is fructose, a main ingredient in table sugar, high fructose corn syrup and fruit that actually gets our cells and alters our metabolism the wrong way. The new findings help to explain how excessive consumption of sweetened foods, soft drinks, for example, is contributing to growing rates of obesity, heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, and more, and in a way that has nothing to do with sugar's rich source of empty calories. In fact, researchers have said that there may be deep evolutionary roots that explain sugar's power over our bodies. Well, many millions of years ago, our ape ancestors developed mutations that made it easy for them to get fat from eating fructose. according to a new study. At the time, the mutation was a good thing. It allowed our ancestors to survive seasonal periods of famine when the fruit trees went bare. Today, the mutation makes a year-round fructose-filled diet dangerous to our health. And that's according to Dr. Richard Johnson, chief of the Division of Renal Disease and Hypertension, University of Colorado, Denver. Both sugar and high fructose corn syrup are equally bad because they both contain about the same amount of fructose. Quote, this mutation that occurred 15 million years ago could explain why we're fat today. It doesn't mean we're all going to become obese. It doesn't mean everyone is going to get diabetes. It doesn't mean that all of us are more susceptible to being fat than most other mammals. In the new study, the researchers identified just such a mutation that affects how our bodies deal with uric acid and ordinary byproducts of metabolism. So this was published in the Transactions of the American Clinical and Climatological Association, a peer-reviewed journal. So stay away from the fructose. Stay away from all of the different processed sugars. You want something sweet? Stevia. Raw honey. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Joining me in, not joining me in studio, but being in our studio in New York City, I'm out on the road filming, is Kara Lee, our program director. Hi, Kara.
Good afternoon, Gary. Well, you know, there were just a couple articles that were forwarded my way, and I thought I could bring a couple of your attention, and maybe you could articulate some of them even better. The first one, which I thought was really interesting, was by Norman Solomon, who's also a host on our network and has a show tonight at 6 o'clock on the Progressive Radio Network. And he just wrote an article about how it's a time for action and the importance of independent media to foster change. I mean, obviously, he's doing a show on PRN and internet broadcasting, so he understands this as well. But I thought maybe, Gary, you could help stress to the audience the importance of this article.
Well, let me just cite something from Richard Wolff, The Myth of American Exceptionalism. I won't go through it. It's short. It's about 3 minutes long, but it ties into what you just mentioned with Norman Solomon. I'll quote this. One aspect of American exceptionalism was always economic. U.S. workers, so the story went, enjoyed a rising level of real wages that afforded their families a rising standard of living. Ever harder work paid off in rising consumption. The rich got richer faster than the middle and poor, but almost no one got poorer. Nearly all citizens felt middle class. A profitable U.S. capitalism kept running ahead of labor supply, so it kept raising wages to attract waves of immigration and to retain employees across the 19th centuries until the 1970s. Then everything changed. Real wages stopped rising as U.S. capitalists redirected their investments to produce and employ abroad, and while replacing millions of workers in the United States with computers. The U.S. women's liberation moved millions of U.S. adult women to seek paid employment, and U.S. capitalism no longer faced a shortage of labor. U.S. employers took advantage of the change situation. They stopped raising wages. When basic labor scarcity became labor excess, not only real wages, but eventually benefits, too, would be stopped and they're being raised. Over the last 30 years, the vast majority of U.S. workers have, in fact, gotten poorer. When you sum up flat real wages, reduce benefits, you know, reduce pensions, medical insurance, etc., reduce public services and raise tax burdens, in economic terms, America's exceptionalism began to die in the 1970s. The rich, however, have gotten much richer since the 1970s, as every measure of U.S. income and wealth inequality attest. The explanation is simple. While workers average real wages stayed flat, their productivity rose, the goods and services that an average hour's labor provided to employers. More and better machines, including computers, better education, harder and faster labor effort, raised productivity since the 1970s. And while workers delivered more and more value to employers, those employers paid those workers no more. The employers reaped all the benefits of raising productivity, rising profits, rising salaries and bonuses to managers, rising dividends to shareholders, and rising payments to the professionals who serve employers, meaning lawyers, architects, consultants. And since the 1970s, most U.S. workers postponed facing up to what capitalism has come to mean for them. They sent more family members to do more hours of paid labor. They borrowed huge amounts. By exhausting themselves, stressing family life to the breaking point in many households, and by taking on unsustainable levels of debt, the U.S. working class delayed the end of American exceptionalism until the global crisis hit in 2007. By then, their buying power could no longer grow. Rising unemployment kept wages flat. No more hours of work, nor more borrowing were possible. Reckoning time had arrived. A U.S. capitalism built on expanding mass consumption lost its foundation. The richest 10 to 15%, those cashing in on employers' good fortune from no longer rising wages, helped bring on the crisis by speculating wildly and unsuccessfully in all sorts of new financial instruments, asset-based securities, credit default swaps. The richest also contributed to the crisis by using their money to shift U.S. politics to the right, rendering government regulation and oversight inadequate to anticipate or even moderate the crisis or even to react properly once it hit. Indeed, the rich have so far been able to use the crisis to widen still further the gulf separating themselves from the rest, to finally bury American exceptionalism. First, they utilized both parties' dependence on their financial support to make sure there would be no mass federal hiring program for the unemployed, as FDR used between 1934 and 40, the absence of such a program guaranteed that real wages would not rise and with job benefits would fall, as they indeed have done. Second, the rich made sure the prime focus of government response to the crisis would benefit banks, large corporations, and stock prices. These have more or less recovered. And third, the current drive for government budget austerity, especially focused on the 50 states and thousands of municipalities, forces the mass of people to pick up the cost for the government unjustly unbalanced response to the crisis. Now, what does this mean in lay language? Here's what it means. That on the one hand, when we are told that it's time, like Norman Solomon and others and myself are saying, let us be honest today. The government is not going to help us. The federal and state governments and local governments are going to be cut back substantially. Some of those cutbacks are necessary because we had excessive bloat, we had pork, we had massive conflicts of interest where enormous industries like the military-industrial security complex and the energy complexes were built upon government subsidies, meaning taxpayer subsidies. So they got all the benefits, we did not. So the jobs you've lost are not coming back. Right now, Brazil, China, India, South Korea, Indonesian countries are booming in no small measure because they had unlimited amounts of inexpensive but trained labor. So why should a company, let's say you are a motorcycle company and you're right here in the United States, but when you look at what a cost of a motorcycle is in the current economy, a lot of people can't afford it, but what if you could bring that motorcycle in at half price instead of $5,000, $2,500? But when you look at the cost of insurance and benefits and union wages, you're going to say if you own that corporation or could, gee whiz, it just is not profitable. But what if you went to China or India to make the same identical motorcycle, except there you don't have to pay workman's compensation or health benefits, no OSHA, no environmental regulations, you don't have unions, and you can pay the worker $3 a day. Here it was $30 an hour. So now you bring it in at $1,000 and you can sell it at $2,000, making 100% profit. And that's what's happened. As a result, we've had massive amounts of factories close. Over 45,000 factories have closed in the United States that were manufacturing items in just the last 10 years. All right? And those jobs are not coming back. So now there's a massive rush by corporations in America to offshore their jobs. What has increased in the United States are McJobs, working at McDonald's, working in service industries and hotels and restaurants and resorts. In other words, where you're working for a very low wage with minimal or no benefits so that the max amount of profit goes to the corporation. Now, there's two ways of making a profit. Either you make a profit, and by making a profit, you share that profit with your workers. You share it within your community by creating a community outreach support system. You sponsor a little league. You build a park. You build a children's crisis center. Whatever it is, you show that you're connected to your community, not for PR, but because you're intrinsically a part of that community. Or you do more often than not what is being done. You say, why should I care about the local community? I don't care about them. I don't have to. I'm going to make 10,000% profit. I'm going to bet against the price of wheat. I'm going to commodify my investment. I'm going to go into currencies, wheat, water, and we'll cause the price of that to double. Now, the fact that someone may not be able to afford the food because you have played in the market becomes irrelevant to you. All you care about is, boy, did we just make a killing. You know, we just shorted the bonds in Greece because we don't think that the government will be able to continue to sustain paying a 7% interest because they're already 140% debt against their gross domestic product. So they're going to go broke. So we're going to short them. You make a bundle of money. Greece tumbles. People suffer. That's how money is made today. Money is made off money. And that goes to a select small group of maybe 600,000 to 700,000 people at the low end and about 3 to 4 million people at the high end in the financial service industry. And they have access to the Federal Reserve, the Treasury. They get bailed out. They cannot fail. And they're getting money at zero interest with no requirements. There's no transparency. It's all opaque. You and I can lose our home, our job. We can go hungry. There is no guarantee that any American will be fed. We're going to double the amount of people on food stamps in the next 3 years. I predict we'll have 19 million Americans, almost one-third of the American population, on food stamps within 3 years. So what do you do? Do you wait for this colossus bureaucracy of ineptitude and corruption to come to our rescue because we like some smooth-talking politician telling us he feels our pain, as Bill Clinton did, or, you know, no more old politics as usual, as Barack Obama? No, because we know whose interests they serve. Instead, we go off the grid. We start tearing up our credit cards. We file bankruptcy. We take our money out of all commercial banks and put it into small savings loan that we check to make sure are not involved in credit default swaps or derivative positions and or credit unions. We start to learn new skills. We grow food. We barter and exchange. We work in cooperatives and collectives. We look for healthier places to live. That's what the people have a choice of doing. Or taking the skills they have before it gets bad and downsizing their life so no matter what happens, they're not going to be caught unprepared. Now, the older people will not do this, with rare exception. They will not. At least 50 million Americans are safe enough and have pensions and Social Security and don't have debt, so they will weather this fine. And they'll live in safe green zones. But for 270 million Americans, they're going into a very dark and bad place. The stock market will artificially go up, and yet their lives will go down. The commentators who didn't see any of this coming on television will tell them everything's fine, all the while they're wondering how to feed their children. So we now have two realities in the United States. the reality of those who have and those who have not, or not enough. And nothing being done by Democrats or Republicans will change any of this. We need a completely new, independent, progressive party. It does not now exist. It will take at least 2 to 4 years to organize and get these people together. But once they are together, they will be the dominant political party, and then they can go in and make constructive change. But until that happens, go off the grid and support local, bring it back to reality, sustainable homestyle, homestead choices. That's what I would suggest, and that's what I believe Norman is suggesting. Thanks for your input, Carolee.
Thank you, Gary.
Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Continuing our discussion on the condition of the American media in attacking, mercilessly attacking, Dr. Andrew Wakefield and his colleagues, making statements against them, but without really taking the time and scholarship to verify that the original complaint that he had fraudulently manipulated the results of a review of 12 persons in England that had gastrointestinal disturbances after taking the MMR vaccine. At no point did Wakefield actually state that there was a connection between the MMR vaccine and autism. That was made out of clear cloth, and that should have been a red flag. But everyone in the American media has been taken in by Brian Deer, the accuser. Now, seeing the quackbusters in America lie constantly and having no qualifications in what they're talking about, but only in courts have they been discredited completely. But the American media still supports them, and yet they have nothing legitimate in their background. But they have enormous power. They're affiliated with a lot of the pharmaceutical interests. They're completely aligned. The question then is, how could you attack and destroy a man's reputation, call him a fraud, call him a liar, call him everything, and not present independent research to prove your point? And what about some sense of fairness? Shouldn't you also invite the person to defend themselves without first condemning them? That has not been the case. And I especially ask you to look at any of the statements by Anderson Cooper on CNN as the example of what I consider the worst possible type of journalism. This is McCarthyism, McCarthy journalism at its worst. This is yellow journalism. So to give us a different perspective, we have invited J.B. Hanley, along with his wife, founded Generation Rescue, and today they are doing some independent research on this. Nice to have you with us today, J.B.
Gary, thanks for having me.
J.B., let's go through the accusations. The most current accusations are that Wakefield was trying to get rich with $42 or $43 million in some scheme to make some drug that would impact on autism, and therefore he had to scare people into believing that there was this happening. So I got to ask, let's go through this first and determine who is his accuser. What have you been able to find out about Brian Deer and his statements on the record, not third person, not hearsay? Let's keep it that if we can't prove the statement against Deer, we don't make the statement against Deer, because we will not fall in the same trap that Anderson Cooper and the rest of these people call themselves journalists. So let's go through what we can actually prove about Deer and his statements, and then measure that against the facts so we can get a different or more honest perspective. The
Absolutely.
Form is yours. Go ahead.
The first thing we know about Brian Deer is that he's an independent journalist. He often characterizes himself as a Sunday Times journalist, which adds a certain amount of pedigree to what he's saying. But we have an explicit quote from the Sunday Times that we put on the Age of Autism blog that disowns any affiliation with Brian Deere. So the first thing we know is that he's an independent journalist for hire.
Okay, do you have that to quote?
I can pull it up while I'm talking to you. So yeah, I'll get it for you in just a second here.
Okay, because as we go, anything you have that challenges what he has done, I'd like to hear it.
Yes, CNN routinely refers to him as a Sunday Times journalist, and he routinely confirms that he is. And yet, here's a quote from the Sunday Times legal office. It's quite clear that you don't understand English. Brian Deere is not a member of the Sunday Times staff. He's a freelance journalist who runs his own website and blog. It is not under the control or direction of the Sunday Times. Mr. Deere should not represent himself as a Sunday Times journalist. He's not a member of the staff, does not have a regular salary from us, is not in our pension scheme, and pays his own taxes as a freelance. So there you go. It can't be much more clear than that. That's Alistair Brett, legal manager, Sunday
Times. Okay, well, then that makes a lot of difference, because suddenly that recasts his so-called authority as a Sunday Times reporter, as Neville Hutchinson was, science editor. So, you know, when you're writing for the Sunday Times, there's an assumption that it has even more respect than the New York Times. So right now,
no doubt,
they all should recheck at the door, allowing this man to say something based upon his affiliation with this paper.
Yeah. The next thing that we can't understand, you know, Andy Wakefield went through 160 days of a hearing at the General Medical Council, and Brian Deere attended every single day of that hearing. A journalist named Jane Bryant asked him explicitly who was paying for all his times here. He said back to her the Sunday Times and Channel 4, and we got confirmation from the Sunday Times and Channel 4 that they were not paying for his attendance. He then asked more explicitly and wouldn't give an answer. So the truth is, we don't know who's sustaining this guy, who's had very little in the way of published articles since about 2003. What we do know is that when Brian Deere first took up his investigation of Andy Wakefield, he was assisted by a group called Medico Legal Investigations, who's supported by the British Pharmaceutical Council, who explicitly stated that they supported Brian Deere in his investigation. In fact, they used to crow about it on their website, but they took it down. So we know that for certain, that he was at least assisted by a group that's backed by the British pharmaceutical industry. So that's for sure. We also know that the former editor of the Sunday Times who hired Brian Deere had a father who sat on a health council in Britain that had to go through a very embarrassing removal of an MMR vaccine in the late 80s from the market. So does that mean that that editor went after Andy Wakefield to protect the reputation of his dad? Impossible to know, but just another potential piece of the puzzle. I want to get to something else, though, Gary, that you mentioned earlier that I think is way more important and way more incriminating, and something that I can really talk about in terms of fact. The accusation that Brian Deere is making against Andy Wakefield is actually very confusing for the general public, but simple to understand. When you're in Britain, you go to a general practitioner doctor, and they keep a file on your child. Parents of children with autism, like myself, all have horror stories of dealing with local doctors who didn't understand the complexity of the condition going on with our children. So typically, we're referred on and referred on and referred on until we find somebody who actually understands what's going on with our kid. In Britain, the Royal Free Hospital, where Andy Wakefield worked, is one of those places. It's sort of Mayo Clinic-like in terms of having experts in many different fields. And parents of children with autism who are suffering from extreme bowel disease, immune systems upside down, et cetera, would routinely get referred to the Royal Free Hospital. But in Britain, those records from your general practitioner don't travel with you to the major hospital. It's the job of the Royal Free to start from scratch and make an entire separate diagnosis of what's going on with the child. Brian Deere's entire accusation of Andy Wakefield is that the general practitioner records that he has access to and the Royal Free records don't match. And because they don't match, that's fraud. Now, that would be like having some unique condition that your doctor can't figure out, but he keeps a bunch of notes on. Then you go to Mayo and they get the condition properly diagnosed. There's a difference between your local doctor and the Mayo, and then you accuse someone of fraud. That's how absurd what's being done here really is. And I think the most important data set, and the data set that I've spent all my time, is the parents of the children. The parents of the children are available in Britain for interviews. I personally introduced a parent of two of the kids in the study and one other parent of one of the children in the study to CNN after the yellow journalism by Anderson Cooper. I completely agree with your characterization. One of the parents was on her way to a studio to be interviewed, at least on the Parker Spitzer show, and they pulled the interview. I know for certain that 11 of the 12 parents, because I can't comment on the 12 because I've never been able to find them, would support Andy, and they would say that the gap between their GP and the Royal Free are subtle gaps, that they were treated with great respect, and that the representations made of their children in Andy's original study in 98 are completely accurate. So that's the big thing here, is that you have a nuance that Brian Deere has captured and decided to call fraud. The Royal Free doctors literally had zero access to the original records from these patients, and you have the parents all on Andy's side saying, no, the study is absolutely representative of my kid and accurate to what happened to them. That, I think, is the great crime here, is how easy it would be for an honest journalist to go talk to the parents in Britain and see how their story differs from what's being told. None of these parents were ever allowed to speak at the GMC hearing, which was the trigger for Andy losing his license in the first place.
Well, to me, that's a kangaroo court. And by the way, on Thursday this week, we'll be showing that this is not unusual in England, that there are multiple cases where something that went against the Crown, went against the British government, was then hidden, lied about, or covered up, including one, I won't even get into the IRA, where several of the Irish spent years and years in jail when the government knew that they were innocent and later were freed, but long after they should have been. Not one of the people who did engage in the cover-up were held accountable. In fact, no one has ever been held accountable for any of the cover-ups. And I think that's important. Also, the lies, out-and-out lies. If you say that Andrew Wakefield said that the MMR vaccine was causing autism, that's a lie, because he never said that. That wasn't in his writings. That wasn't in his statements. Yet that's what's being promoted all over the media. This man said there's an association between the MMR vaccines and autism. Have you found that association?
What I think is funny is, I actually think it's comical, there has been this revision of history to make it sound like Andy's 98 paper triggered a vaccine panic around the world. As an American parent, I can tell you that I hadn't even heard of Andy Wakefield until probably 2005. His paper had absolutely nothing to do with my fears about vaccines and autism. When I began vaccinating my son in 2002, I'd only heard the first whisper, and it was sort of a hippie whisper that there might be something here, but I didn't give it much thought. It wasn't until about midway through 2003, when my son went upside down after a vaccine appointment, that I started to take this stuff more seriously, as you can imagine. And so this idea that Andy's paper, which to your point never even mentioned that they'd found an association between MMR and autism, was somehow a trigger point for a worldwide panic is absurd. They're trying to put the genie back in the bottle. The real panic, if you will, the real publicity around this issue has only been in the last 3 or 4 years when people like Jenny McCarthy started talking in a much louder way. And they're trying to revise history to make this seem like it was all Andy's fault. So if he's a fraud, the whole thing's a fraud. Can we please all move on? And it's just not going to work. The reason it's not going to work is that these kinds of things don't resonate unless the population shares the point of view. And you can't walk through any neighborhood in America without finding a parent whose kid went upside down after a vaccine appointment. So it resonates. When I walk through the halls of my elementary school, I'm not a pariah. I'm a guy who people want to understand, hey, what happened to your kid? How can I avoid that? I heard some others it happened to them too. What do I do to get around this? That's the reality of what's going on in America, and the media's mischaracterization of history is not going to do anything to change that.
Well, but it's not, the media does not create history. The media reports on what it's told to report, and that's frequently biased. So first they lied about Andrew Wakefield making a statement that autism was associated. He did not. I read the paper very clearly. Also, Andrew Wakefield was pro-vaccine, so therefore he was not an anti-vaccine advocate. So then it ends up that all he found was that there was some correlation in the patients with gastrointestinal problems that may have come from the MMR. Well, the parents already have attested to that. Prior to Andrew Wakefield, they saw that there were problems. And Brian Deere, on his way into one of those hearings, was shown a photograph, a large photograph, one you could not mistake what was in the photograph. It was, I'm going to guess, a 3-foot by 3-foot photograph of one of the children from one of the parents and he has a colostomy bag where his entire colon was removed, and because of the severe inflammatory response inside this. And yet Deer is looking right at the woman in the photograph and denying that this was a gastrointestinal problem. And the woman is saying, do you think they take out healthy colons? Do you think they give a kid a colostomy bag that they has to wear for the rest of his life for no reason? And that was such an important point when I saw that. So discuss that, but also then I want you to get into the affiliation, and here's where it gets for me as a journalist, and a real journalist, not the Anderson Cooper journalist, where no one can find a story. I've done so on over 300 occasions. Boy, were there red flags all over Brian Deer's affiliation or association or alignment with the pharmaceutical industry on vaccines. Take us to
Absolutely.
Those associations now. All right.
Yeah, I will. And let me just talk one quick thing, and then I'll jump to the associations. I know the parent who showed Brian Deer the photo, who has that child who has a colostomy bag. I think you could go on and on about what a difficult character Brian Deer is, but that would all be sort of ad hominem, right? The real question is he saying things that are true or not? And I'll just go back to it. The parents all say he's not. They were perfectly willing to get on CNN with Brian Deer. In fact, they were begging to have Deer in the room for these interviews, and yet CNN deferred and chose not to. And I just think that's criminal if you're trying to get to the bottom of the story. If all the parents agree with Andy, if they all say that the way their kids were characterized in the study was accurate, who are you supposed to believe? But if you never have access to that information, only one side comes out. You know, what's interesting about Deer is that when you go back into his history, We know that medico-legal investigations helped advise him and that they're supported by the British pharmaceutical industry. One other thing we know, and a name that nobody in the U.S. would know, is a guy named Dr. Evan Harris, who is a member of Parliament. He was a doctor, much as Bill Frist was a doctor, but he was also a member of Parliament, much like an American congressman. He was helping Deer from day one. He was visiting the Lancet. He's been on the record extremely supportive of the vaccine program. He was a Glaxo Welcome Fellow. Glaxo Welcome, of course, is a vaccine maker.
They make the vaccines.
They make the vaccine. And his father, Evan Harris's dad, sat on the Committee on the Safety in Medicines from 1990 to 1992 during a period when they had to withdraw an MMR vaccine that was damaging kids that was very, very embarrassing. So this guy latched onto Deer from the get-go. He was a very powerful congressman. He was clearly supported by the pharmaceutical industry because he was a Glaxo Welcome Fellow. He'd also been an active member of the British Medical Association, who owns the British Medical Journal. So we're starting to see some ties in here that are very, very clear. The next one is Lancet. Lancet is the publication that in 98 put out Andy Wakefield's paper. Well, in 2004, the CEO of the Lancet joined GlaxoSmithKline's board, which was right around the time the Lancet threw Andy Wakefield under the bus and let his study kind of blow in the wind during the GMC hearing. So Dr. Sir Crispin Davis, who's the chief executive of Reed Elsevier, which is the owner of the Lancet, joined the board of GlaxoSmithKline in the summer of 2003, right before the Sunday Times article came out. So there you go. There's another interesting angle. And then the Sunday Times editor who hired Deer is a guy named Paul Newke, and he's the son of Professor George Newke, who was on the Committee on the Safety of Medicines when both the MMR and Plusarix vaccines were introduced. So you have Deer surrounded by an editor whose dad was on the board of something, a congressman who's a doctor, I say congressman to use the American equivalent, yeah, exactly, who was a doctor. You have medico-legal investigations. It starts to look to me, and this is more conjecture, that Brian Deer is really a journalist-for-hire stooge with a lot of powerful people behind him.
At the very least, based upon the prima facie evidence, Brian Deer should not have his word and the only person to attack this group as the definitive word. And also, he has not been transparent. He has not turned over his banking records. He has not turned over his income each year for the last 10 years to show where was he making his money. At any time, was he given any consulting fees from any of the front groups for the vaccine company, because vaccine groups won't give you money directly. They give their money to foundations that they control. The foundations give it to research groups that are front groups that then hire people who are going to bid their will. So we have not seen this kind of work. If Brian Deere were that concerned, let him come forward with all his bank statements. Let us see where he made his money. Right now, based upon what I know about Brian Deere, I would consider him extremely biased. I would not take anything he said without challenge. And at no point can we show that Andrew Wakefield or any of the other scientists who were looking at the irritable bowel condition benefited in any way. To the contrary, they all lost tremendously. Wakefield lost his license to practice medicine. He has been hammered in his reputation. And yet, in America, we tend to jump on. We don't tend to look. We take sides immediately. And there's only one side when it comes to vaccines. All American journalists jump on the pro-vaccine bandwagon. It's a disgrace how completely aligned American media is with a pharmaceutical company until you look at 90% of the ads on television on certain shows, and they're all pro-pharma, with a side effect frequently being death. And you hear them say, if you're taking Celebrex, one of the things, side effects is death, and one of the sleeping aids, death, and one of the anti-inflammatories, death. And yet they're making billions of dollars. So instead of looking at this honestly and objectively and looking for the truth, they start off with a lie, and now they got to cover their own asses. They have to protect their own reputations, and that is wrong. Now, in 2 days from now, I will be doing a special with the parents. These 12 parents, or as many as we can, will be on, plus some physicians from England who independently saw this, and I'm going to hold a report from Harvard. Harvard researchers confirmed the GI inflammation link. And this is in volume 20, number one of Autism Research Review International in Biomedical Update. Quote, Harvard physician recently reported that biopsies performed by him revealed the presence of chronic inflammation of the gastrointestinal tract, as well as the presence of nodular hyperplasia in 15 of 89 autistic children. The findings parallel those of Andrew Weil, the researcher who first identified the presence of a unique type of gastrointestinal disorder in children with autism spectrum disorder. The scientist told a conference, quote, these children are ill, in distress and pain, and not just mentally, neurologically dysfunctional. So there's another scientist now from Harvard confirming what Andrew Weil's group did. Are they going to attack him now? Are they going to attack this Harvard researcher? Are they going to smear him? And then also, how about the professor, Richard Death, professor of immunology, who also came up with the idea that these kids did have inflammation because of the MMR vaccine, even if the MMR had no mercury or aluminum. They had the viruses themselves which caused inflammation. So now we have two professors in specializations, one from Northwestern University, the other from Harvard, confirming Andrew Weil's work.
Now yeah, and Gary, just to clarify, Richard Dietz is from Northeastern.
Northeastern, yeah.
Not Northwestern, yeah. But just to, let's talk about that for a second. You know, on the one hand, I'm very grateful for the work that Andy Wakefield has done. He has documented clearly that children with autism are suffering from severe gastrointestinal distress. On the other hand, telling that to a parent with autism is like trying to explain to them that kids with autism have trouble talking or socializing. We all knew that, and we've known that for a long time. The much larger question, and the question that's not getting asked properly, is whether or not it is, in fact, vaccines that are driving all this autism. And what's extremely frustrating, coming from a person like me who has read literally every document written on this topic, every piece of science published, is how little work has actually been done and how easy it would be to do this. Let me just give you a quick example. There's a 2003 pediatric study that is often cited as proof that vaccines don't cause autism. The only thing the study did was look at vaccinated children who got a bunch of mercury in their shots and compare them to vaccinated children who got a little less mercury in their shots. And the conclusion of the study was that they could neither prove nor deny the hypothesis. Now, as absurd as that sounds, that's actually the number one most cited study proving vaccines don't cause autism. The science actually done to date, despite wild misrepresentations from the other side, doesn't really exist. And it would be very easy to do. There's two things you could do. The first thing you could do is take a group of children who'd been fully vaccinated and compare them to a group of children who'd received zero vaccines. We know that's about 3% of the U.S. population, whether it's for religious, philosophical, whatever the reason might be. Those children are already out there. All you need to do is go find out what their autism rate is. If it's 1 in 100 amongst unvaccinated kids, I'd say that's a condemning data set for thinking vaccines are causing autism. The other thing you could do is an animal model. Take a group of primates who are the closest biologically humans and vaccinate them. Take another group of primates and don't, and then see if there's a difference in health outcomes. Well, the bad news for the other side, the bad guys who continue to assert that all vaccines are fine and this isn't harming our children, is that work like this is finally getting done. The State University of New York at Stony Brook looked at a group of kids who got the full series of Hep B vaccine and compared them to a group of kids who didn't get any Hep B vaccine. Finally, somebody looking at a control group who didn't get vaccines, and they found a dramatically higher rate of autism in the Hep B group. A group at the University of Pittsburgh is doing a study right now, vaccinating one group of primates and not vaccinating another. They've published two of the five or six studies they're going to do on this, and the first two are exceptionally damning in terms of the health outcome of the vaccinated group of primates. So we're finally starting to see the real and honest science. And I am telling you, Gary, it ain't looking good for the other side. That's why we're spending all this time on silly conjecture, historical revisionism, and miscasting with Andy Wakefield to try to distract from the real science that's starting to get done, well, that's relatively straightforward to do, and that could finally put this issue to bed.
J.B. Hanley, we're out of time. Thank you and your foundation, Generation Rescue, for the work that you're doing to inform the public. My audience knows that when you have millions of Americans who have seen what has happened with their children after a vaccine episode and almost universally denied any legitimacy, denied help, denied the knowledge that the vaccine did this, now we have a tsunami of parents who are refusing just to accept the official position any longer, irrespective of what the Anderson Coopers or Dr. Gupta or others would like us to believe. The truth will win out, and when it does, we will see that the Andrew Wakefields and others will be exonerated. Thank you very much for your work.
Thanks, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, and overnight, 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. on the East Coast, go to GaryNall.com for my six-hour program on KPFK, our sister station.
Cowboys, girl. I remember when I used to play shoot 'em up, bang, baby.
The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.